All rise. Chief Judge and Justice of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're here for oral argument in the case of the United States versus Verdejo Ruiz. Are both sides prepared to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
In defense, I understand that you wish to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir.
Very well. Defense, you may proceed.
Thank you.
Chief Judge Allred, Judge Mitchell, Judge Weber, may it please the court. The OSI agents in this case agreed under oath that an accused could reasonably believe that they had promised him confidentiality. Your Honors, they were right, and here's why. At 16:32 in the videotaped interrogation of Tech Sergeant Rafael Verdejo Ruiz, the agents told him, "You don't have to worry about anything you say to us. We are not trying to throw you up by a stake or anything else." At 16:42, so 5 minutes later, the same agents told Sergeant Verdejo that everything that stays in this room stays in this room. And then 5 minutes later, so at 16:47, they told him, "The Air Force is not going to judge you. Over the years that I have done this, the only time I have ever seen the Air Force judge anybody is if they come to an investigator and they lie. That is when the Air Force judges somebody." Your Honors, these are just three of the six false promises of confidentiality made by the OSI agents who interrogated Sergeant Verdejo Ruiz. The first of these six promises came within just minutes of the agents' admitted efforts to minimize the importance of the Article 31 rights. These promises preceded numerous incriminating statements made by Sergeant Verdejo, made very close in time to the three promises that I've already discussed. And the promises continued throughout the course of this interrogation, which ended shortly after Sergeant Verdejo expressed his confusion about how those statements, his incriminating statements, would be used against him when he asked, "Is this a court-martial thing?" Your Honors, in addition to these six false promises of confidentiality, over the course of the approximately three-hour interrogation, the OSI agents lied to Sergeant Verdejo on at least 29 occasions. They told him four separate times that it was fine or perfectly fine to have had consensual sex with a 13-year-old girl. They threatened his career, and they told him that if he were lying, that is when he was going to have to stand by the fire with his feet to the fire. And again, they told him that the only time the Air Force judges somebody is if a subject lies. Your Honors, all of these false promises, these lies, these threats to his career happened during an interrogation of an airman who had no prior experience with the criminal justice system, who just a few weeks prior to the interrogation had buried his 11-month-old daughter, and who was being asked about having had, quote, perfectly fine consensual sex with somebody 6 years before. And Your Honors, despite clear law to the contrary, the military judge erred in denying the motion to suppress. And specifically, the judge erred by failing to engage in the analysis mandated by the Supreme Court in Schneckloff versus Bustamante. And then he erred again by essentially using Sergeant Verdejo's 1168, which he completed at the conclusion of the interrogation, as a quasi-cleansing statement.
Let me ask you a question. You would agree, though, that OSI agents can mislead a suspect in terms of what evidence they have?
That is true, Your Honor.
They could tell the suspect that they have DNA evidence or fingerprint evidence when no such evidence exists.
That is correct.
So why is this different when you talk about the lies that OSI did?
Because under Schneckloff, what the trial judge was required to do in this case was to analyze certain factors that the Supreme Court has laid out.
Was he? What is a promise of confidentiality? Isn't it fairly similar to a promise of immunity?
Yes, Your Honor.
promises for immunity tested under the Schneckloss test for voluntariness, or is the test from RCM 704 apply?
Your Honor, it would be under Schneckloff. It's a factor. It is not dispositive of voluntariness. The courts have been pretty clear that while under Bram, this...
Well, what does the doctrine of de facto immunity say then? Do we test that for a voluntariness under the totality of the circumstances test, or do we just look to see under equitable estoppel principles that the person being interviewed reasonably relied on those promises of immunity?
Your Honor, I think it could be analyzed under either test. The test that the courts have laid out, my understanding is it is the totality of the circumstances, which is why Schneckloff applies, but the conclusion is the same. In either situation, in looking at either Schneckloff or an equitable estoppel theory, Sergeant Verdejo relied on those promises, believed that they were not going to be used against him, and ultimately confessed to at least one incident of sexual assault.
You say he believed those promises and he relied on them. The military judge explicitly found to the contrary, did he not?
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor.
Is that a finding of fact?
It is not a finding of fact, Your Honor. As you pointed out in Lovely, a finding of fact is essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here, but a finding of fact is a circumstance, an event, a deed that exists, and it is not an interpretation. And in this particular situation, the judge, what he explained was that Sergeant Verdejo, he found Sergeant Verdejo's testimony to be without merit because it defied common sense. That's an interpretation. It is not a circumstance. It is not a deed. So it is not a finding of fact. And for that reason, this court should not give any deference to that. It would be different if the trial judge had said, based on my observations of Sergeant Verdejo, based on his demeanor, based on the way in which he testified, I find him to be incredible. But that's not what the judge did.
Instead, so the question of whether the appellant in this case relied on those promises of confidentiality, as you characterize them, is that an objective test or a subjective test? Because that makes a difference as to whether it's a finding of fact or conclusion of law, does it not?
It would be objective, Your Honor, under United States versus Salazar, which is a 2004 CAF case, and I can provide the court the citation for that at the conclusion of my argument. But CAF has been pretty clear that in determining the reliance on a promise or the voluntariness of a confession, it is judged on an objective standard. So it would be a reasonable person in the situation of Sergeant Verdejo, what would they understand? And that's an important distinction because I anticipate that the government is going to rely heavily on the judge's finding that Sergeant Verdejo's testimony lacked or defied common sense. But just to be clear, based on this court's decision and analysis in Lovely, which was just published recently, what the military judge found would not qualify, at least what the judge found as it relates to Sergeant Verdejo's credibility, would not be considered a finding of fact. And again, the standard of review in these particular cases is de novo. As the Fulminante court explained, in reviewing the voluntariness of a confession, it is reviewed de novo, and the government bears the burden of establishing the voluntariness.
Is it de novo? Ultimately, I agree, CAF has repeatedly said that the sort of application prong of this mixed question is reviewed de novo. But in Freeman, which is one of the seminal cases here, CAF calls the standard both de novo and abuse of discretion. They cite Gore for the proposition that the abuse of discretion standard recognizes that there's a range of choices and the judge will not be reversed as long as he or she remains within that range. What's our standard of review here?
It is that mixed standard of review, very similar to Lovely, where, yes, the military judge's conclusions of law are reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard, but the ultimate determination is reviewed de novo. And so it is a mix, but regardless, the military judge did abuse his discretion in a variety of key ways.
Counsel, let me jump in here for a moment. Coming back to something that Judge Mitchell asked about, we know that within the bounds of the law, the OSI is able to use tricks and ruses in order to interrogate and question suspects, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, I assume that you have looked at the videotape as I have, and tell me if you would disagree with this. It appeared to me, as I watched that videotape, that the technique, if there was a primary or a focus one from the OSI, their gimmick, if you want to call it that, was you open up with us and things will go well for you. So they seem to drive that, they seem to go with that theme quite frequently. And I thought, I didn't do a tally, but I thought I heard many, many times, perhaps a dozen or more times, you tell us, whatever you tell us, we're going to take to your commander, and you shoot straight with us, and it's going to go well for you when we talk to your commander. Wasn't that an element of the discussion that was there?
That was a definite element, Your Honor, but the...
And didn't they, here's where I'm going with this, didn't they tell the appellant many times that what he told them was going to go to his commander?
They ultimately told him at the end of the interview that they were going to go to the commander and essentially tell the commander...
No, I'm not talking about the end of it, all through the interview. Didn't they tell him repeatedly that they would be taking things to his commander? And the real question is, do you disagree with that assessment of what went on in the interview?
I do disagree with that, Your Honor. They certainly did tell him on a couple of occasions that, yes, they were going to go to the commander, but where they really focused on that was at the end of the interrogation. They told him that they would be going to the commander and telling him essentially whether Sergeant Verdejo had been cooperative and honest. And yes, certainly they were talking to him, trying to get Sergeant Verdejo to believe that they were there to help him, that the only way he could get in trouble was if he lied. And that's why that statement at 1647 is so important, because what they told Sergeant Verdejo is the only way the Air Force judges somebody is if they lie. And what happened in this particular case, in the military judge's ruling in denying the motion to suppress, the judge erred in finding that every single one of these false promises or these statements that the trial defense counsel complained of were made in the context of Sergeant Verdejo's concern about his wife or family members finding out about his infidelity. And, Your Honors, that's simply not the case. That conclusion of law is arbitrary and flies in the face of what was actually presented on the record through the videotaped interrogation and through the transcript. Now, I will concede that three of the six statements that we've complained of here arguably were made in that context. So the very first statement, which was something along the lines of, don't worry about it, we're not going to talk to anybody, that was about 11 minutes into the interview. That does appear to have been made in response to Sergeant Verdejo's concern that his wife would find out about it. The last two statements that we've highlighted in our motion, in our brief, those arguably were made in the context of Sergeant Verdejo being concerned about his wife finding out. But the three, starting at 1632, the statement about, we're not trying to throw you up by a stake, and concluding with the statement that the only time the Air Force judges somebody if they lie, those clearly were made in a different kind of context. It was a context in which the agents were talking about whether Sergeant Verdejo had actually committed a crime. They were equating what he had done with punishment. You know, the use of the word stake is clearly a reference to some type of corporal punishment. Using the word judge, the only time the Air Force judges somebody, that's clearly in reference to being in trouble, being punished. And so the judge erred. He abused his discretion in finding that all of the statements were made in the context of Sergeant Verdejo's concern about his wife finding out. The other thing...
Wasn't there also discussion, though, of the OSI even saying, essentially, I'm not here to judge you, that's not my job, my job is to find out what happened. Shouldn't that be taken into consideration as well? Not only his wife judging him, but then he also, your client talks about his concerns about his father judging him also. So shouldn't we take all those into consideration when determining the context in which these statements are made?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, this court's required to take in the totality of the circumstances. The last listed Schneckloff factor is the details of the interrogation, for example, what is said during the interrogation and what tactics the police use. And so when you had asked earlier about the lies that the agents told him, yes, while the agents are allowed to lie in an interview, the courts are still required to take that into consideration. Under this last Schneckloff factor, which weighs heavily in favor of the defense, there were coercive techniques going on. Yes, they might have been lawful, they might have been legal, but the point is, they still were coercive. When you take into account the lies, when you take into account these false promises, especially the three that I've highlighted here, they were designed to overcome Sergeant Verdejo's will, to overbear his will and get him to confess to something. Now, importantly, the agents, they testified under oath that it was reasonable and even very reasonable that an accused in Sergeant Verdejo's situation would believe that these were promises of confidentiality, that these, that what he was saying truly would not leave the room. And importantly, Sergeant Verdejo first admitted to the crimes shortly after the agents promised him confidentiality. So for example, at 1632, they tell him, hey, we're not going to throw you up by a stake or anything else. About a minute later, Sergeant Verdejo, for the first time, says, pretty much it happened and we just move on from there. And he was referring to sexual acts with this 13-year-old girl. Then again, when the agents tell him at 1642 that everything stays in this room, and then at 1647, they tell him, hey, look, 90% of the people we talk to, the subjects we talk to, have not committed a crime. So again, that's something that this court needs to take into account, because the agents are telling him at the beginning of the interrogation that he's suspected of a crime, and they advise him of his rights. They admit that they minimized the importance of those rights. The agent acknowledges that at page 484 in the record, that he minimized the rights. So on one hand, you have them, the agents telling him, hey, you are suspected of a crime, and these are the ways in which we can use your statement. And then over the course of 3 hours, they're telling him, hey, 90% of the people we talk to don't commit crimes. The only time you can get in trouble is if you lie. They lie to him about the state of the law. And they're giving him these promises.
Counsel, what was the statements that you say that they lied to him about the state of the law?
They told him on at least 4 separate occasions, Your Honor, that it was fine or perfectly fine to have had consensual sex with a 13-year-old girl. And the case law, there is case law that strongly suggests that, yes, while OSI agents, law enforcement agents can lie, it's a different story when they're lying about the law. In fact, in United States versus Cudd, the Court of Military Appeals inveighed forcefully against these types of techniques, lying about the law as well as making promises of confidentiality or essentially giving de facto immunity.
So are you asserting that when the appellant walked out of that interrogation room, presumably in his mind he believed he had told the truth, and based on OSI's promises, as you characterize them, he thought nothing was going to happen to him?
Correct, Your Honor.
Is that what your position is?
Yes, it is. And that's...
And maybe sometimes we have a little different interpretations of what we saw in that interrogation, but I seem to recall, and you can correct me if your memory is different, but I seem to recall him asking at the end whether he might be court-martialed for this. He seemed to understand that was very much on the table, and the OSI said, that's not our business. And it seemed to be a very clear meeting of the minds that anything could happen after that interview. Certainly no impression that he thought that he had now only spoken to things that were not offenses.
Yes, Your Honor, that is one interpretation. But another interpretation, the one to which Sergeant Verdejo testified to, was that he thought the only way he could get in trouble was if he did not cooperate with OSI or if he had lied to them. Now, Your Honors have seen the video. He spent a great deal of time during that interrogation denying any kind of activity with CL, with the 13-year-old complainant, only to ultimately admit to one act of sexual intercourse. And so when he made that comment, is this a court-martial thing, it was made in the context of the OSI agents telling them, yeah, we're going to go to your commander and tell him whether you've been honest. And
let me follow up with something that Judge Weber asked about, and we touched upon it earlier, but clearly the military judge heard that testimony from the accused and very clearly dismissed it and found it not credible, correct?
That is what he found, yes.
That is what he found, and whether we call them findings of fact or something else will be an issue for us to think about. But to what degree, what weight do we give that finding of the judge, the fact that he found him not to be credible on the witness stand?
Your Honor,
where does that factor into our deliberations here?
Based on the way in which the trial judge analyzed his testimony, you're not to give it any deference. Because it was not a determination based on what the judge saw. Importantly, and I believe this is page 157 of the record, importantly what the judge said is that the testimony defied common sense. It wasn't that I observed Sergeant Verdejo and based on his demeanor, based on the fact that he was sweating profusely or not making eye contact, I don't find him to be credible. Instead, what the judge said was, I find that this defies common sense because he gave an 1168. And the trial judge focused heavily on the subsequent 1168, and that also was an abuse of discretion. Because essentially what the trial judge was saying was that if there's any problem with the coercive technique, if these promises or these statements from OSI can be viewed as coercive, then it was cured by the later 1168. And that's wrong. Because in order for the judge to reach that conclusion, he needed to go through the analysis required under Brown versus Illinois, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case. Essentially what the judge is saying, and I anticipate what the government is going to argue, is that 1168 served essentially as a cleansing statement. The problem with that, Your Honors, is the 1168, it is not preceded by a proper cleansing statement. The OSI agent, I believe it was Agent DeMoore, admitted under oath that he did not re-advise Sergeant Verdejo of his Article 31 rights. Instead, what he did is they have this interrogation in the interrogation room. Then they immediately take him across the hall, and this part is unfortunately not videotaped, but Agent DeMoore said they take him across the hall, they remind him of the previous Article 31 rights, which they of course minimize at the beginning of the interrogation, and which they spent 3 hours confusing Sergeant Verdejo so much that he asks, is this a court-martial thing at the end? They give him the form. The agent does not go over the form with him. He just says, hey, read this and initial it. There's no evidence on the record that Sergeant Verdejo, he did initial, but there's no evidence that he actually read the form and understood his rights.
Other than his initials by each statement saying, I read and understand these rights.
Correct, Your Honor.
So isn't that evidence in the record that he read and understood those rights?
I would concede it's a presumption, but there's no evidence. It would be different if the agent said, yeah, I went over the form with him, I read the rights out to him, I had him initial, or it took him 5 minutes to go through.
Just to clarify this, your argument is the fact that his initials are on the form saying I've read and understood my rights is not evidence that he has in fact read and understood his rights.
I would agree that it's a strong presumption that he did. But the problem, Your Honor, is that in order for this 1168 to serve as a cure, as the Brown court put it, it has to be an intervening circumstance that dissipates the taint of the coercive prior interrogation. The problem is those rights advisement on the form, the agents admitted that they had spent 3 hours threatening him, threatening his career, promising him, they don't say that they promised him confidentiality, but they do admit that they told him everything that stays in this room, and you know the various statements that we've talked about. And so what the agent needed to do is explain to him, look, maybe you were confused by what happened in this prior interrogation, and as a result, whatever you said in that prior interrogation can't be used against you. That would have been a proper cleansing statement under Cueto, which is a CAF case. They didn't do that. They simply reminded him of the Article 31 rights that he'd had before, which they had minimized and confused him, and then gave him the form and told him that he was simply to summarize what had been discussed in this prior interrogation. And of course, it is our position that that prior interrogation was coercive. And so the judge, importantly, the trial judge, not only did he not go through the Brown analysis, which he was required to do before he could even look at that 1168 as a cure to the possible course of taint of that prior interrogation. But had he done so, he would have found that the temporal proximity of it, in addition to the lack of intervening circumstances, did not dissipate the taint of that prior interrogation.
Counsel, I want to turn back to this assertion that the agents told him it was lawful what he did not violate the law, as opposed to minimization in terms of saying, hey, there's parts in the interview where they say, look, everybody makes mistakes. You probably thought she was older than she was. She looked fully developed, and she initiated the activity. Where can you orient me again as to where they said what you did was lawful and did not violate the law?
Yes, Your Honor. They did tell him. I see my time is concluded. May I answer your question?
You may.
They told him on four occasions, and I don't have the pinpoint sites right now, but I'd be happy to provide them to the court. But they told him on four occasions that it was fine or perfectly fine to have had consensual sex with a 13-year-old girl. And of course, we know that is an incorrect statement of the law.
But hadn't he also expressed concern about the term rape? And the appellant was the one who brought up and said, anything I did was with consent. Now, we as attorneys understand legal ability to consent, but your client, it seems, at least through the interview, was concerned that it was by force, let's say, and he was making clear that it was not a forceful situation. So doesn't that minimize your position?
It does not, Your Honor, and the reason for that is because the agents, I mean, you're dealing with somebody who has had no prior experience with the criminal justice system. There's nothing on the record that would suggest he's ever been interviewed as a subject, as a witness, that he has ever been involved in any kind of disciplinary proceedings, either as an airman or as a supervisor. And so while it may be difficult for us as JAGs to understand his confusion, again, it has to be his situation and what's going on in this interrogation has to be viewed under that objective standard. And the problem is, yes, he did bring up the word rape himself, and the agents told him, hey, there's a night and day difference between rape and consent. But the problem is, at a time when the agents admitted that they were getting frustrated with his continued denials, they're promising him confidentiality and telling him things like, hey, it's perfectly fine to have sex with a 13-year-old as long as it's consensual. And we know that that's not true. That is a lie. It's a misrepresentation on the nature of the law. And under that last Schneckloff factor, this court has to consider that because it weighs into the overall tactics that the OSI agents were using in an effort to get Sergeant Verdejo to confess. And if there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks. Government?
Good morning. Chief Judge Allred, Judge Mitchell, Judge Weber, may it please the court, I'm Major Daniel Breen, and along with Mr. Roger Bruce, we represent the United States in this matter. In response to appellant's assignment of error, it's the government's position that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in denying appellant's motion to suppress his statements to law enforcement. Now, during appellate defense counsel's argument, there was some discussion of the standard of review, and the standard of review in this case is that it is mixed. The denial of a motion to suppress a confession is reviewed for an abuse of discretion, and this court will not disturb the military judge's findings of fact unless they're clearly erroneous or unsupported by the record. However, whether the confession is voluntary is a question of law, which is reviewed de novo. When conducting this review, it requires an examination of the totality of circumstances to determine whether a confession is the product of essentially free and unconstrained choice by its maker.
just to clarify, it's the government's position that the application prong of that mixed question, essentially the ultimate question about whether this confession was voluntary, is reviewed de novo.
That is correct. You take all of the facts that you've reviewed, whether they're clearly erroneous, and then whether that those facts apply to the law, that's reviewed de novo. And that leads to an interesting, because as appellate defense counsel accurately predicted, the government is heavily going to rely on the judge's determinant of credibility in this case. And it can't be understated, Judge Cumbie's finding, that this court finds this testimony to be totally, completely, and unequivocally without merit. His testimony defies common sense and is inconsistent with the video interviews in the Air Force Form 1168. I don't make that finding lightly. I make it after having spent 26 years in the United States Air Force, almost exclusively in the military justice arena, and the last 11 years as military judge. Now, appellate defense counsel would like you to believe that you shouldn't give this deference. He argues that somehow credibility determinations are only based upon visual cues and not based upon comparison of evidence that's presented. The government would vehemently argue that that is not correct. As a matter of fact, in Chatfield, 67 MJ at 440, CAF determined that the court would grant great deference to a determination because the military judge was in a unique position to determine the appropriate way to give appellant's assertion that his will was overborne. And this is another case where a judge found the appellant's testimony to be severely without merit. The other important aspect to look in this case is context. Picking out individual statements in a vacuum does not satisfy the totality of the circumstances of analysis. Judge Albright, as you indicated, you've seen the video. I'm sure the judges have seen the video and the transcript. That is everything. You're going to have everything there to make your determination. Nothing's in a vacuum. Secondly, in terms of the 1168, another important aspect is this isn't just a cleansing statement. The 1168 is part of the totality of circumstances. It was part of the evidence that was provided to show the conduct of the entire interview. And that is particularly important because the 1168 had a severe amount of minimization. It had victim blame in it, which runs contrary to some sort of belief that he maintained that all of these statements were going to be held in confidence. Now, another important aspect is to go ahead and look at the characteristics of this case. Although appellate defense counsel criticizes the judge for his findings, he did look at specific circumstances. Appellant had been in the Air Force for 10 years, was an NCO for 6 years, and had already reached level tech sergeant. He could speak and understand English and was not visibly under the influence of drugs or under pain or duress, and there was no evidence in the record that appellant suffers from any type of mental deficiency or is of low intelligence. And, of course, the ultimate finding that the appellant lacks such little credibility that a judge of his stature can be so shocked in 26 years. And judges, in your experience, you know that this is something that's rare. So this is really getting home how poorly his credibility was. Whether he was sweating or not isn't the factor. It's the ridiculous nature of his statements. Now, appellate defense counsel makes one interesting comment. He keeps referring to the death of a child. However, it's important to know that that issue was not brought to motion and it wasn't argued. It didn't even come up until the record at 110 during cross-examination of trial counsel during the motion hearing. And I would like to refer this court to United States versus Lloyd, where the military judge cannot be found to have abused his discretion by failing to adopt a theory that was not presented during trial. That is just going back and trying to pick something out in order to buttress a already weak argument. Now, in terms of the big picture of this, of the conditions of interrogation, he was read his Article 31 rights. He stated he understood them. He was free to terminate the interview at any time. In fact, he recognized on two occasions that the agents could terminate the interview on their own. He was not questioned for a prolonged time or held in isolation. He was provided with and accepted opportunities to smoke, use the bathroom, drink water. And also, looking at what was not done, he was not threatened in any way. He wasn't physically harmed. The tone was conversational. And he ultimately prepared the 1168 himself outside the presence of any investigator. Another really important factor in this case is the appellant's level of participation. This was not a passive interviewee bending to the will of what has been characterized as coercive tactics. Appellant was able to answer questions with "I understand" or "no problem" 32 different times. He ultimately, in answering specific questions of whether he committed misconduct, answered "I don't remember" or a variation of thereof on 29 different occasions. He asked 7 questions. And also, a very interesting factor is who was actually controlling this interview. When you look at the transcript and compare it to the interview itself, the number of times they interrupt each other, it's pretty easy to see with all the dash dashes as they keep talking over each other. There was over 100 times that the agents and appellant interrupted each other. So this was not someone passive, bending to the will, doing whatever to get out of the interview. And as a matter of fact, in the very end, the interesting thing was, while the appellant was talking, Special Agent Dean Moore actually tried to get him to stop by saying, "Look, we're going to be here all night tonight. I have a 4-month-old to get home to and a wife." That is the coercive nature of the situation, is the agent trying to get out of there at that point. Other aspects in terms of
its position that this interview was not sufficiently coercive as to render the confession involuntary. Apart from the comments that defense has cited here, I mean, OSI implied several times that if the appellant told the truth, his career could or would be salvaged. If you look at page 18 to 19 of the transcript, quote, "This is where you have the option to A, go on and save your career and have a long living career, or B, you can lie to me and you are going to watch your career flush down the toilet. Page 28, we want you on that path where 10 more years you are retiring. Right now you're a 10-year tech, you could easily make senior in chief the way you're going right now. That is what we want, but like I said, you need to come to that minute detail and you need to come to remember. Page 33, we're not here to get anybody in trouble, the Air Force is not going to judge you." Do these comments also provide some support for a conclusion that the appellant reasonably believed that if he told the truth, he would not be in trouble? He'd go on and, as the agent said, finish his career.
The government does not believe that. Because first of all, if he actually believed, if I tell the truth and answer what the agents want me to, then I will save my career, then he actually would have agreed with them instead of continuing to disagree. He continually, after each one of these promises or these discussions of judgment, maintained that he didn't do it. After the first alleged promise, although appellate defense counsel appears this time to concede that that wasn't a promise, he was able to deny claims 8 times. After the second alleged promise, which is the, now I guess the infamous put you up on a stake, which merges the judgment aspect of it. I wouldn't agree that that's punishment. I believe that's referring to judgment. The appellant's next response to that was not a confession. It was that he didn't remember. And if you look at the context on page 29 after that, that is when they went through a detailed discussion of whether he sexually assaulted the victim in the home. And he never admitted to it, ever. The time that he ended up admitting to anything was when they told the Josh and Tebow story, where they talked about the stolen television, and the key to that was, who do you think the commander is going to be more lenient with? And that is an important merger here, because it's the understanding that the commander is going to make a determination based upon the conduct of somebody telling the truth. And that's when he starts to give in and he starts going through the, well, I had sex in a car, it might have been an Amanda or it might have been the victim. Although he did still continue to backtrack after that. This is not a situation where his will was so overborne by these innocuous statements that he just couldn't handle it and went ahead and caved in and admitted to everything that was presented to him. He continually minimized, he interrupted, he questioned, he attempted to control, and he attempted to pull the wools over the eyes of the agents and later when he testified during the motions hearing. And none of it made any sense.
I'll ask you a similar question that I asked the defense. Let's assume that statements like the ones I just mentioned constitute de facto promises of immunity. I understand that's not the government's position, but let's assume that we found that. is the proper test the Schneckloff voluntariness under the totality of circumstances test, or is the proper test the one outlined in RCM 704 for de facto immunity? In other words, that the when a person testifies or makes statements pursuant to a promise of immunity, then those statements may be inadmissible.
Your Honor, the government didn't have the opportunity to brief or review that issue as it was not brought on appeal. It is our belief that 704, the agents do not have the authority to grant immunity. So this wouldn't be a 704 analysis. This would still be a totality of the circumstances analysis. And the ridiculousness of the appellant's testimony was demonstrated during the motions hearing. And this is the most important factor in undermining every supposition that you can have at this point, because it shows how ridiculous a belief that the OSI was just investigating the truth. He understood it was a criminal investigation for sexual assault. He testified to that. He talked about how when I'm in a room, I did something wrong. He used the word rape himself. He testified if she's the accuser, because I'm being accused, and when you're being accused of anything, you've committed something wrong or a crime, then it would be Caitlin, so that's what I'm saying. If I'm not being handcuffed out of here, I will be okay. If I am, can I have a smoke break? I really do not, I mean, being handcuffed for not cooperating is ridiculous. And of course, as was discussed during the previous argument, is this a court-martial thing? Further, the OSI agents explained to him on at least 15 different occasions about their responsibilities, including their duties to prove and disprove allegations, prepare report, and advise commanders. Now, however, he goes ahead and testifies that he believed that OSI was only going to write a report for a commander, but the report would only deal with his level of cooperation. So even though the agents have told him that they interview everything from stealing paper to murder, he is explaining to the military judge that he believes that they just bring people in, ask them if they murdered somebody. They say, yeah, you know what, I cut my wife's head off. And then OSI agents go ahead and tell him, thank you so much for your cooperation. We'll go ahead and let your commander know that. Write an 1168 for us where you talk about murdering your wife. We'll just shove that in a file somewhere, but everything's good to go. That is where you get into where this defies common sense. Because apparently, in his mind, writing 1168s is a fun exercise for OSI. Because what other purpose would there be? In fact, upon questioning by the military judge, appellant asserted that even if he admitted to having sex with an underage victim 25 times, it was not going to be reported to anyone. And he then reaffirmed, in his own words, OSI is a special investigations unit. They merely investigate whether someone is cooperative or not. Once again, that is ridiculous. And when you look at what he was talking about in terms of his 1168, that he was only summarizing what the conversation was, a lot of the minimization that is contained in the 1168 was not discussed during the interview. He was obviously knew his commander was going to look at it. And then finally, and this is Appellate Exhibit 15. I committed the alleged action of having intercourse in the vehicle, and although I'm very sorry about my actions, I'm willing to accept the responsibility. Well, accept the outcome. What is he accepting the outcome of? Because if he's just reporting whether he's cooperative or not, that's meaningless. And that's the whole situation here, Your Honor. I can't stress enough, and I'm just going to conclude on this point. You've got the rest of the brief to go through details. Subjectively and objectively, there's no way that he believed that OSI was just investigating the truth. These statements were made in response to his concerns about his wife finding out and comments that he made, such as, I don't like being judged by anyone. And looking at the totality of the circumstances, there is absolutely no way that his will was overborne. Put quite simply, the military judge did not get it wrong, the prior panel didn't get this wrong when we heard an argument before, and this panel is not going to get it wrong. Therefore, the government would respectfully request this court affirm the findings and sentence and approve this case.
Thank you. Defense rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
do want to quickly hit on several things that the government argued. First, the government pointed to Chatfield as support for why this court should give deference to the military judge's credibility determination. Please go back and look at Chatfield, because what the trial judge in that case found, and this is at page 437 of the opinion, quote, the military judge found appellant was a defensive witness with an aggressive attitude who was unconvincing due to the manner, tone, and content of his responses. That is a finding of fact, because that is a deed, a circumstance, something that exists, as this court pointed out in Lovely. That's very different than what we have here. What we have here is a military judge who is making a credibility determination not based on an aggressive demeanor, not based on defensive attitude, but on the finding that his testimony defied common sense. That's an interpretation, and as such, it is not a finding of fact. I'd also like to point out that the government argues that Sergeant Verdejo somehow controlled this interview, that it wasn't coercive because he was asking questions, he was interrupting the agents. That's not the test. The test is under the totality of the circumstances. And yes, while we will concede that some of the Schneckloff factors do weigh against us, for example, as the government pointed out, Sergeant Verdejo, there was no physical coercion. He was not under any kind of mental defect, although there was some evidence presented that the agents knew he was concerned about some of the things going on in his personal life, and he was susceptible to acquiescing to what they were telling him had happened.
But Counsel, let's put it as susceptible to acquiescing. Aren't there multiple times throughout this interview where OSI agents say something happened at the house and he says no? He repeatedly denies essentially allegations that OSI is repeating. So that, isn't that the totality of the circumstances, that he's not simply acquiescing to everything the agents are saying that he did?
Yes, Your Honor, but the key to this case is the 30 minutes or so starting at 1632, because that is when the agents first bring up this idea that they're not going to, the Air Force is not going to punish him, he's not going to get in trouble. And that 30-minute period is critical, because that's when Sergeant Verdejo first starts admitting culpability. So at 1632, they tell him, hey, we're not here to throw you up by a stake or anything else. And within 2 minutes, Sergeant Verdejo says, yeah, pretty much it happened. And then throughout that 30-minute period, he is admitting that, yes, something happened with CL, and specifically, he says that at 1653, so this is just a few minutes after he's told the only time the Air Force judges you is if you lie, he says he will accept the allegation that he had sex with the complaining witness. At 1655, so 2 minutes later, he admits to having sex with someone in the car. And at 1706, he finally and unequivocally admits that he had sex with CL in the car. So, and the important thing about that 30-minute period is the agents admitted that they started telling him things like, we're not here to throw you out by a stake or anything else, because they were frustrated with the denials. So contrary to what the government's position is that he was somehow, Sergeant Verdejo was somehow controlling this interrogation, that is not what happened in that 30-minute period. And the important thing, Your Honors, is the judge is required to analyze those facts. He was required to analyze the Schneckloff factors, and he didn't do it at all. He invoked the talismanic incantation of the totality of the circumstances, and yet never analyzed the impact of those three statements during that 30-minute period and the causal connection between those statements and his ultimate admissions. And just briefly, Your Honor, I would point out in response to Judge Weber's question earlier to me and to the government, under a de facto immunity theory, under 704, the discussion points out that when a person testifies or makes a statement pursuant to a promise of immunity or a similar promise by a person with apparent authority, Such testimony or statements and evidence derived from them may be inadmissible at a later trial. I see that my time has expired. May I briefly conclude?
Finish. Go ahead and finish your thought.
Your Honor, contrary to the government's position, these agents had apparent authority to promise leniency, to promise immunity. In looking at the situation in an objective person standard, and looking at the situation that Sergeant Verdejo, somebody who is not a JAG, who is not experienced in criminal justice, it was reasonable for him to believe that he had been granted immunity. And importantly, the agents understood that. There were three people in that interrogation room, Your Honors, three people. And every single one of them agreed that it was reasonable for Sergeant Verdejo to believe that he had been granted either immunity or some kind of promise of confidentiality. The military judge completely ignored that fact and abused his discretion in finding that Sergeant Verdejo had voluntarily confessed. And because the military judge abuses discretion, this court, by misapplying the law, this court must find that the confession was involuntary and that it was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, given the great weight that trial counsel placed on these admissions and on the 1168 in closing argument.
Thank you. Anything further from the colleagues here?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. I'd like to thank, go ahead and have a seat there. I'd like to thank both sides for their hard work and preparation. I don't know if it amounts to an OPR bullet, but the Chief Appellate Judge at least found your presentations to be highly professional. And with that, we will begin deliberations and render a decision in due course. Thank you. The court is now closed.
All rise.